Thank you, sir.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Well, is it a little like drinking from a fire hydrant, all these lectures every day, so much to take in? I'm sure. What a lovely and wonderful preaching we just heard. I remember a missionary friend of mine saying one time, you have to be very careful not to make enemies in this world. Because if you make enemies, you have to love them. Just thought about that when you were preaching. It was just terrific. My goal has always been, in teaching art and music history and appreciation, has always been to sort of reverse what the typical way people think is. That is, people usually say, I don't know art, but I know what I like. You hear that a lot? I don't know much about music, but I really love, you know, what I love. And I tell them, by the end of my class, my hope is that you'll say, you know, I'm still trying to decide what I like, but I know art. Wouldn't that be great? That's what I'm after. Because what we like, you see, and what we don't like is only a portion of who we are and what we're about. We're taught in our society today that our preferences are almost the most important thing in the world. What I like, what music I like, what paintings I like, what shows I like, movies, and so on, that's who I am. And what I would like to do is sort of dislodge that notion from our minds and start thinking about how we might evaluate a piece of work and see whether or not it's actually worth or worthy of our love. The temptation is to think that what I love is who I am. But what I'd like to do is say that the fall actually affects what we love. In other words, our sensibilities, our affections, are dented, damaged, bent by the fall, just like everything else. So education is not simply a matter of teaching facts. Education is for the purposes of learning to love that which is worth loving. That's the purpose of education. Education is so that your sensibilities might actually attach themselves to things that are inherently worthwhile. You see that? And we don't always like to think of it that way. We think, well, the music that I like, well, that's who I am. That's what I like. And that's, who can question that, right? But I am questioning that. I'm questioning it for me as well as for you. And is it possible for us to find in music, and that's what I'm going to be talking about tonight, a particular piece of music, something that's actually worthwhile inherently? How many of you read The Abolition of Man? All right, a few of you know it. Very good. If you haven't read it, drop everything. If you can't afford it, hop your sofa, you know, buy it, read it. C.S. Lewis's best work, nonfiction kind of stuff. Anyway, so what I want to talk about tonight, and that's what that's all about. I'm not going to go into it, but that's what he's talking about in the first chapter or so of Abolition of Man. What I want to talk about tonight is a piece of music that I think exemplifies the principles that I tried to lay out in our last session. The last session we talked about two things. Remember what they were? The two things that we have to appreciate? Imagination and patience. That's very important. Encouraging our patience. Right. Well, what if a piece of music were to do the same sort of thing? Tax us in our imagination and tax us in our patience. That the Hamlet soliloquy did and the Job 28 chapter did. Well, that's what I want to do. I want to play you a piece of music that is by a fellow called Johannes Brahms. Johannes Brahms lived in the middle of the 19th century, German composer. And he wrote a piece called Eine Deutsche Requiem. Now, if you know what a requiem is, it's a funeral mass. It's a Roman Catholic funeral mass. Right. And every mass has its own series of texts. And composers down through the ages have taken the Requiem Mass and they've put it to music. Various people have. Mozart. There's a famous Mozart Requiem. There's a famous Verdi Requiem, the Italian composer Giuseppe Verdi. Giuseppe Verdi means in Italian it's Giuseppe Verdi, in English it's Joe Green. Sounds much more impressive, doesn't it, in Italian? Giuseppe Verdi. Anyway, Joe wrote this great Requiem Mass. It's rather frightening, actually, in part. If you've never heard it before, listen to that. But Brahms wrote a Requiem, too, only he titled it not Requiem. He titled it Eine Deutsche Requiem, which means a German Requiem, which means a Protestant Requiem. That means a Lutheran Requiem. And it's not the German Requiem, it's a German Requiem, as though you could have others. And instead of taking the texts from the old Roman Mass for the dead, like all the other composers did, he chose his own texts. He went back to his Lutheran Bible and he picked out verses that he wanted to set to music. So, in the old Roman Mass, it starts with Requiem aeternam et Lux aeterna luceat eis. For those of you who are not Latin scholars, that means rest in peace eternally. And may light eternal shine on you. Now, who's the subject of that text? The man who died, the one who died, right? The person who's dead. May light eternal shine on you, you have passed away, right? Right. Rest in peace, you who have died. Brahms instead decided to set as his first text, Selig sind die da Leid tragen, which in German means blessed are they who mourn. Isn't that wonderful? Selig sind die da Leid tragen. Now, blessed are they who mourn. Who's the subject of that sentence? The mourners, the living. Many people call the German Requiem the Mass for the living. It's the Mass for those who are mourning, having lost someone. And the texts are all in German, all from the Lutheran Bible, and all chosen by the composer. So the one I want to tell you about is the second movement, and how many of you, let me just ask a question, how many of you have heard me talk about the Brahms Requiem second movement before? Okay, for you I have something extra. I didn't realize there would be anybody here who had heard this talk before. So I'm going to actually talk about the second movement because that's on the agenda, but I'm also going to try and save enough time that we can talk a little bit about the third movement too, which is a wonderful movement. And you, if you don't know the piece, you need to learn all seven movements. We're not going to talk, we haven't got time for all seven. But we'll talk about the second because, precisely because it's a good example of the sort of principles that I've been talking about. But the third movement is priceless in its own way, and I thought maybe we'd get to that one too. So give me patience, and I'll get to that one as well. No pun intended. Perhaps it was intended, I don't know. Hard to know the darkness of my own heart here. Anyway, the text that he chooses for his second movement is 1 Peter 1:24 and 25, and I'm sure you know it. It goes, all men are like grass, and all their glory is like the flowers of the field. The grass withers, and the flowers fade or fall, but the word of our Lord stands forever. Now, you remember how in Hamlet, the Hamlet soliloquy, the punchline, as it were, the key line, was three quarters of the way through. And he put that punchline off for a long time, right? That three quarters of the way through before he got to it. In the Job passage, the punchline, if you can allow that metaphor, was the very last verse of the chapter, right? There's a great deal of chapter before we get to the bottom line. Well, Brahms looks at this text and he says, all men are like grass, all their glories are like the flowers of the field. The grass withers and the flowers fall, and then he stops. And he goes back to the beginning again, and he says, all men are like grass, as though you didn't get it the first time. And all their glory is like the flowers of the field, the grass withers, and the flowers fall. By now you're saying, but the word of the Lord stands forever. Come on, come on, come on, come on. Where is it? Right? Where's the rest of the verse? He doesn't tell you. And he switches gears altogether. And he changes the music, and he changes the text. He goes into James, where it says, so be patient. I think it's James 5. Be patient, therefore, brothers, as you wait for the coming of the Lord. Be like the farmer who waits for the precious fruit to come out of the ground, all of his planting. Be patient for the morning and the evening rains that bring this fruit, he says. And then finally he says, so you should be patient. That's how you should be, just like that farmer. By now you may have forgotten the line, but the word of the Lord stands forever, because you've wandered off a field, right? Then you know what he does? He goes all the way back to the very beginning of the piece, and he starts it as if he's never said a word. And he does the long introduction, and he has them sing, all men are like grass, and all their glory is like the flowers of the field. The grass withers, and the flowers fall. And he stops a third time. And you know what he does? He goes back to the beginning, and he says it again. All men are like grass. If you're not getting it by now, you're not going to get it. Four times through, he says, the grass withers and the flowers fall. Stop. And then out of the silence, at the end of that paper, he says, has the entire chorus come in and say, Aber, which in German means but. Des Herren Wort, the word of the Lord, bleibet stands. And then he says it again, bleibet stands. In Ewigkeit, in eternity, forever, which is the punchline of the piece, right? But he wanted you to hear four times through that first part before he said, you're ready to hear this last. And the question for us has to be, just like with Hamlet, just like with Job, why did he write it like that? Why did he bother with the whole first part of it at all? And I think you'll agree after hearing it that it sets the tone, it sets the place, it helps your heart conceive, appreciate the depth of the first part of that. And when your heart really appreciates that, then you truly appreciate the sun shining at the very end, that there is something that's eternal, that there is something to cling to, that we're not just here and gone tomorrow for no reason. We need to attach ourselves to this Herren Wort, the word of the Lord, because it stands in eternity. And by the way, when he gets to singing Ewigkeit, which means eternity, he sings it like this. Ewigkeit. So even when he gets to eternity, he makes you hear it for eternity. This is the sort of thing that's going on in music. Let me give you a quick example, too. In music, people don't often understand that the way the music is composed and what the music is saying, just like our point all morning, all day today, have to go together. A lot of times you'll hear, especially in church, you'll hear a song and words put together, and they don't really go together. There's a sort of intensity or lack of intensity to the music, and the opposite in the words. I used to get a guitar and go, bum bum bum, Jesus died on the cross for me, bum bum bum, Jesus died on the cross, bum bum bum, you know, like a little country western little ditty, you know. And somehow that dum dicky dum dicky dum dicky dum doesn't go with probably the most profound thing that anybody's ever said in the English language. Jesus died on the cross for my sin. You can't put those two things together without there being a kind of dissonance, cognitive dissonance. But you can, in many cases, great composers are the ones that can put the two things together that do. They craft the music to make sense of the words. You find a word that's important to say, and then you craft the music to be able to say it. You know Handel's Messiah, don't you? You know the tenor aria from Handel's Messiah? It goes, every valley, have you heard this? Every valley shall be exalted. And then he does a crazy thing. He goes, shall be exalted. Like that. Oh, no. Go listen to a really good tenor sing it. You'll be real. You'll think, Hodges, why did you do that? Anyway, but that's what it does. And what does exalted mean, anyway? To be lifted up, right? So it goes, and every mountain and hill made low. You see it? The crooked straight. And the rough places plain. The crooked straight, the crooked straight, and the rough places plain. It's not by accident. He didn't do it accidentally, and we all went, ooh, that's cool, let's keep that. The music actually is crafted to be able to interpret the words. You see that? Okay. Well, Brahms did the same thing in this second movement, except in a more subtle way. I mean, that's pretty obvious. By the way, that's what they call tone painting, in case you're interested. That's called, you see it a lot in Baroque music, Handel, Bach, in the B minor mass all the time, in Handel's Messiah various times. Go back and listen for tone painting. Look at what the word is and see why the word is set the way it is, and you'll catch all sorts of cool things. Well, what Brahms has done is he's written a funeral dirge. And it goes like this. Starts off, body, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, and three, one, two, and three, one, two, like that. Body, slow, dirge-like tempo in B flat minor. Well, it occurred to me when I conducted this piece several times. And it occurred to me when I was studying it the first time that it felt like a dirge. It felt like a march, like a funeral procession march. And yet, it's in 3 beats in the bar. You'd think that, you know, you have 2 feet, marches go 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. Or, you know, really, bum, 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 right? That's a march. So what is this thing in 3, and why does it feel like a funeral? And then it dawned on me. You ever seen a very formal funeral where the people are carrying the casket, and they take a step, and then they put their feet together, and then they take another step, and then they put their feet together like that? Have you seen that? It's beautiful. It's very solemn. And that's what this is. It's 3-1 together. 3-1 together. Bum, dee, bum, bo, dee, dee. It's like that. Dum. So that's how that works. So it has to be the tempo that you can do that. This helps the conductor figure out what the tempo for something should be, you see. Because there's a lot of debate about how fast or how slow something like that ought to go. Okay, well, I don't really believe in PowerPoint presentations. But I have one for you here. Because I want you to be able to see the words, hold on a second. One of the reasons I don't think very highly of PowerPoint presentations is that they don't always work. This is obviously not working right now. So if I can, I'll try and get it to work. I'm sorry. This is what happens to me all the time. Whenever I do one of these things, something technically goes wrong, and I have to keep working at it until I get this next slide up. So it's not actually gonna. I'm sorry. Just hang with me for a second. I'm confused. Ah, there we go. Okay, there we go. All right. I don't know what that was all about, but there we are now. Okay. I think we got the bugs worked out now. Thank you. All right. Well, here's the English on the right there and the German on the left, and I'll try and talk you through this movement. Let's see how it sounds. There we go. Can we go up a little bit? Gear change is moving. harp and the flute imitating rain. Can you hear the rain falling? Hold thy schedule, you be patient. Time to be patient for all. And then it goes back to the very beginning and starts all over. Why do I have to listen to all this again? Why don't you just get on to the bottom line? Brahm says, you're not ready to hear again, eh? You're not ready. Here.
What? Again. Celebration. The adversities, the redeemed of the Lord will come into Zion with shouts of joy. Angels of Freud. Will be on crowns of glory will be on their heads. Death, sorrow will be gone. Get back. That's the Berlin Philharmonic that gets all that applause. They did a great job, didn't they? Sounds very good. No, that's not Berlin. That's Atlanta Symphony. I take it back.
That's Atlanta Symphony with Robert Shaw. Good performance, huh? So that's the piece. Now, do you see why I picked that one? Because it asks you to put off and put off and put off the punchline of the thing long enough to be able to let the framework set. You see what I mean? That's what great art asks. Don't be in a hurry to get to the bottom line, because if you do, you don't get the power of it. I don't know about you, almost every time I hear that, when they finally get to Aber des Herren Wort, my hair stands up. I mean, it's an emotional experience of this glory of this verse. Now, in my church, I attend Second Presbyterian Church in Memphis, and in our church, whenever we read the scripture before the sermon, the congregation all says, all men are like grass. The pastor says, all men are like grass, and all their glory is like the flowers of the field. And the congregation responds, the grass withers and the flowers fade, but the word of our Lord stands forever. Amen. And then he starts his sermon, see? Well, I think that's a great idea. We get to remember that verse. But I'll tell you, the truth is, I never hear that verse in church without that in the back of my mind. That powerful moment where I get the beginning of that verse now. My heart sinks under the tragedy of the fall every time I hear that verse. But then the light at the end of it, that the word of the Lord stands forever, is 10 times brighter because of the contrast, you see? This is what artists see. Remember I talked about earlier today about how the great artist is the guy who is able to see two things that might not be related and see the connection between them. In this case, how music might actually reinforce the verse. You see? Not that I could get up here and read you the verse, and it's the word of God, okay? So it has great power. But what if you were to take what your interpretation is of that word and put it into music in a way that conveys the profundity of a sermon about that verse across to people? I'm arguing that the artist is actually like a pastor who is doing the exegesis. He's interpreting this verse for us and then giving us a picture of what he sees of the depth of that verse, you see? So what Brahms has done is not holy. What Brahms has done is not to be considered equivalent to the revelation of God. I'm not saying that, don't get me wrong. The word itself is the revelation. What Brahms has done is put it in a frame. He's given it to you in a way that you can see it for maybe see the depth in it that you might have missed otherwise. That's all. I had a friend say to me one time many years ago, that listening to great music won't save your soul. And by that he meant also reading great books or looking at great paintings or any of the great art, literature of the past. Reading great books, listening to great music, knowing the Mozart operas won't save your soul. And he's dead on right. However, he said, once you've read those great books, once you've listened to those pieces, you've dealt with these great pieces, there will be more of a soul there to be saved. That's the relationship I'm trying to make. Does that make sense? The art can't take the place of what God has revealed, but it will enlarge you. It'll give you a deeper, more human soul. It still needs to be saved. It's not saved apart from the glory of God, from the grace of God, but it's enlarged. And I think that's part of what it means to be a human being. To grow in our ability to recognize the good, the true, and the beautiful. Okay, well, I think I've got time for a little bit of the third movement. Do you want to hear a little more? Okay. Oh, I forget. I'm not supposed to put that there. In the third movement, the text is, Lord, tell me of the end of my days. Tell me about what it's like for me to come to death. And he writes this for the baritone soloist. This is soloist in the. I told you there are two soloists. There's a baritone who sings in two different movements, and there's a soprano that sings in one. And we won't get to hear her, sadly, but we'll hear the chorus and the baritone soloist. And what the baritone soloist sings is Herr, lehre doch nicht Das ein Ende mit mir haben muss. Tell me of the end of my life. Tell me of the end of my days. I know that my life before you is that. We've got that from the second movement. He says, eine Handbreit, the breadth of a hand. It's only this long compared to eternity. Compared to you, God, who are eternal, my life is over like that. Tell me of the meaning of it. And if you listen to the music of this, it's very clear, it seems to me, that this is a person who is struggling to believe. The music is full of angst, full of doubt and struggle. And eventually the chorus comes in and sings the same bit. Herr, Lord, lehre doch mich, tell me about the end of my days. Tell me about what the meaning is of all this short life that I've got. I know that my life is like a Handbreit. It's just a short period of time. And then the soloist sings some more and talks again about the anxiety that he has about living in this world and what might happen. And he gets up to a fever pitch. He and the chorus back and forth get more and more anxious and more intense until they're singing, Was soll ich mich trösten? In what can I rely? In what can I have, what's a good translation? It's not trust. It's comfort. Thank you. It's comfort. In what can I find comfort? What can I rely on? It's not trust, but what can I find comfort in? Thank you. And that tension, that is it's a diminished seventh chord for all of you music theory nerds. It's this unresolved, very tension-filled chord that doesn't get resolved. It goes bum, 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 stops. And then, out of the silence again, slowly and softly comes a resolution. And it's underneath everything else. And what the chorus sings is, Ich hoffe auf dich. I put my hope in you. And it's this moment of, I think, conversion. It's the moment of getting to the end of yourself and actually taking a breath and trusting God. And from that point on, it's a sort of celebration. It's a different kind of celebration this time. And there's a technical thing I'm going to point out to you for the end of it that you can hear. Do you know what a pedal point is in music? Anybody know? Do you know what a pedal point is? Tell us what a pedal point is. Right. Exactly. You have one note at the very bottom of the score. In this case, it's the instruments, but you could do it with voices too. But the bottom, the basses and the timpani playing the lowest note start this low D, and they play that D for the rest of the piece, the entire way through. And everything above it changes and changes and changes, and all these wonderful things happen, but that D, that low D, never changes. And I can't help but think that that is the stability of the faithful believer. You're now on a rock. Nothing's moving underneath you. And all the transition, all the difficulties, all the ins and outs of life are going to go on above you, but that thing is, Jesus himself is never going to change. He's absolutely secure. So and that's what the words are about too. So I'll play it for you and I'll try and talk you through it. I don't think I have all the words, but where there are words, if I skip some words, I'll translate it hopefully as they go along. Let's see if I can get it on here. Yes. Up a little. There we go. Lord. Eine Handreich vor dir. Mein Leben, mein Tage are this short. Und mein Leben, mein Leib. hear the pedal playing? A couple of pictures I'll show you. I was able to get a chance to conduct this piece in Ukraine some years ago, and the Ukrainian orchestra and chorus from Kiev. And if you've been following along about the news in Ukraine lately, it's a rather war-oppressed place now, in the east anyway. Russia is threatening on the border. So we have a lot of friends in Ukraine that are Christians that are helped get us to do this piece over there. And I took a few singers with me, and an assistant conductor, and a coach, piano coach, player coach. And this is our poster on a deal there in the middle of the town of not Lviv. Anyway, it'll come to me in a minute. But that's me in front of our poster there. And this was a rehearsal. We found that people. Oh, I have to tell you this quick story. The people in Ukraine under the Soviets had a lot of conservatories. There were some really fine music conservatories in Ukraine. Tchaikovsky, for example, did most of his ballet performances, early performances, Swan Lake, Nutcracker, things like that, in Odessa in Ukraine. And they have a long tradition of great music. But when the Soviets took over and Ukraine was a Soviet satellite, they disallowed any works in the conservatories that were Christian. So they wouldn't allow them to sing the Requiem, the Brahms Requiem. Well, that was several generations ago, and the musicians that are playing in Ukraine right now had never played the piece before. Now, it's a little like for us, it's amazing, because this is a staple of Western music. It's a little like saying, hey, you theater group, have you ever heard of Hamlet? And they all go, no, what's that? See? And you think, what a great opportunity. We can do Hamlet here for the first time. And that's how it was. In Western Ukraine, I got to do three or four performances of the Brahms Requiem in Western Ukraine for an orchestra and a chorus that had never sung it before. Great joy, great joy. And so this is a rehearsal, a picture of a rehearsal in the organ hall there in Rivne, it's called. Rivne, that's where it is. It's just west of Kiev. And there were so many interested people to buy tickets, they came, the mayor of the town and the people that were running the organ hall came to us and said, we have sold out all the tickets for the performance of the Requiem. Would you be willing to let us sell tickets to the dress rehearsal? And we said, of course. But everybody wanted to come. And so what you see here is a rehearsal. We're not in concert clothes, rehearsing. And this is, there we are in the orchestra, working the orchestra over. But that's the crowd. This is for the dress rehearsal. There wasn't a seat in the house. Everybody wanted to come and hear this piece. Now, I don't speak Ukrainian or Russian, and so I couldn't tell them about it, but I had a wonderful Christian translator who did know how to tell them, and so I gave a speech before the performance with a little bit of explanation about every movement of the work. Well, the work is all the gospel. So it was a great opportunity to just tell them the story of Jesus and tell them the story in the words of Brahms, you see. So it was actually a kind of an evangelistic event as well. And then we played the piece and they enjoyed it. So there she is. There's my translator while I'm rehearsing. And this was the choral master, the chorus master, the fellow that prepared the chorus for me is a famous choral conductor in Kiev. And he came and rehearsed them all for me before I got there. And got them all prepared. And he came to visit me afterward. I was sick afterward. I caught a bug over there that made me very sick. And I was sort of recovering in my friend's house. And he sought me out. He came and found me to tell me, he's going, this was most gracious performance, you know, and all. And he was telling me all about how it moved him. He is not a Christian. But he conducts in the Orthodox Church, Russian Orthodox Church, Ukrainian Orthodox Church. But he was really moved by the whole thing. I just thought it would be fun for you to see that. So, anyway, that's the Brahms Requiem in a little taste, okay? There are seven movements. You heard the second and the third of the seven. And then what I hope you do is go and listen to the whole thing. And when you do, listen to every movement because every one of them tells part of the story. And then, acting up again, I guess. Thank you all very much.